Our fifth case for this morning is Thomas versus Carolyn Colvin, Social Security Commissioner, Acting Commissioner. Mr. Horn.
Morning, Your Honors, Counsel, ladies and gentlemen. I'm John Horn. I represent Plaintiff Appellant Mildred Thomas. The question is whether the errors committed by the administrative law judge in her decision are harmless or not. And the standard is, could a reasonable trier of fact have come to a different conclusion? And the answer is, of course, a reasonable trier of fact could have come to a different conclusion.
Well, you need more than that. Yeah. You need the necessity to come to a different conclusion, because the administrative law judge has opinions from a variety of doctors in front of her. She's got testimony from Ms. Thomas, etc., and she resolves it by concluding, of course, that she's able to perform her prior job as a phlebotomist. So you have to convince us that that's so far out of bounds that more work needs to be done in this case.
Right. The first error was that the administrative law judge mischaracterized Thomas's testimony about her thumb, which was that she was having no difficulties with her thumb, whereas her testimony was that, yes, indeed, she was, and that when it acted up, she couldn't use it. The vocational expert testified that that would preclude her past work, and she would grid if limited with respect to her left hand as to reaching, handling, or fingering.
Is she right-handed?
I can't remember, but I suspect she probably was. But that
so,
was...
So Dr. Kenny is the one who thinks that she occasionally can lift 20 pounds, frequently 10, stand, walk, etc., and he in turn relies on Dr. Patil, right?
Right, but he mischaracterized what he left out some of Dr. Patil's observations. In fact, Dr. Kenny didn't mention the left hand at all, even though there was evidence of record at the time Dr. Kenny reviewed the file. But far more important than the evidence about the thumb was the evidence about the back and the range of motion. Now, this is more like an error complex. It's really two errors. The administrative law judge said the X-ray was normal, but it wasn't. It showed sclerosis and a transitional vertebra at L5-S1. Even more.
Isn't this case in part about whether there's enough objective medical evidence to support the inference of the pain to which Ms. Thomas testified?
Well, that's another way of putting it, and I've been trying to save the best for last, but
maybe
I'm going to get right to it.
For a 10-minute argument.
The modic changes in the MRI. These are changes that are linked to low back pain. So it's not like Ms. Thomas came in there without a test that corroborated her credibility about the low back pain. The MRI, which came in after review by any of the commissioner's experts, had these modic changes. And the district court put its finger on this at page 8 of its opinion. I think it's page 8, note 3. And said, modic changes are strongly linked to low back pain, and yet the district court just brushed that aside, and it ought not to.
Does she take drugs during the day of any sort?
She takes some medicine. I know she takes albuterol, but of course that doesn't really have to do with her back.
Well,
She takes albuterol. So she has asthma. That's for the asthma? For her asthma?
She has asthma, yes.
Is that what she takes the albuterol for?
Yeah, and she has COPD.
What are the symptoms of COPD?
She has difficulty breathing, and there.
They get that with asthma too,
right?
So during the day, does she have to?
If I recall correctly, she does, and she also experiences what's called stable angina. But none of the tests are.
What does stable angina mean?
Angina.
I know what angina pectoris is, but I don't understand the adjective stable. Does that mean you're okay?
No, it doesn't mean you're okay. It means that she suffers from chest pain on exertion. That's what it means.
So I thought this Dr. Isabel had her on a real cocktail of things. Tramadol, Robaxin, Gabapentin, Ibuprofen, Amitriptyline, Enalapril, Celebrex.
Then I happily stand corrected.
I don't know how long, but I thought that a number of the doctors were prescribing pain medications for her.
Now, she's 5'4".
She's morbidly obese, yes.
Excuse me?
She's morbidly obese.
I can't hear you.
She's morbidly obese with a body mass index of 45.
So she's 5'4", and how much does she weigh?
Enough to generate a body mass index of 45.
Now, is this visible in her walking? Does she look normal when she walks, or is she? Because she also has spinal problems. So does this affect her appearance, or?
The consultative examiner made observations that indicate that. I think so. She had difficulty getting on and off the table. She had difficulty with other portions of the exam.
I thought she had difficulty combing her hair.
She does that as well, too.
Does she have difficulty standing? Does she have to sit down a lot?
Well, she testified to that, yes. If she was found to be sedentary, she would grit. Likewise, if she was found not to be able to use her left hand, that would preclude her past work, and she would grit under Table 2 of the medical vocational guidelines. So, and of course, the administrative law judge used the boilerplate that this court has criticized so often when in analyzing her credibility. So the ALJ got the facts wrong and overlooked maybe the most favorable bit of evidence, which was the fact that these modic changes correlate with low back pain. So it's about as close as we can come to putting a claimant in a machine and have the machine verify the complaints of pain.
Does her weight affect her asthma or her COPD? If you're carrying so much weight like that, does it make it more difficult for you to breathe? Or?
Well, of course it is. Any doctor would tell her she's got to lose weight, I'm sure. So the asthma will be affected by the obesity. So will the mechanical ability to stand and walk. We asked there were enough discrepancies between the
You wanted a pulmonary test, right?
Right. We asked for a pulmonary test. We asked for the opinion of the consultative examiner because his observations were different than those of what the reviewer considered. So I'm into my rebuttal.
Okay, you can save your last minute, and we'll hear from.
If there are any more questions,
No, that's
then
fine.
I'll sit down. Thank you.
Mr. Adili.
May it please the court. The ALJ provided a rationale that ultimately credited the...
What's a phlebotomist?
A phlebotomist is someone who takes blood for medical testing. So.
Now, do you sit or do you stand when you're a phlebotomist?
Well, the vocational expert testified a bit about this, and in conversation with the ALJ, made clear that she would have to be able to stand as required for light work for up to six hours a day, and be able to walk around to be able to perform the job. She would not be able to do it if she were required to sit.
Well, isn't that rather strenuous? Given her physical condition, which is terrible, she's going to be on her feet most of the time. In fact, she's going to be bending over, right?
Actually, if you look at the DOT entry for phlebotomist, which is cited specifically in the ALJ decision, it requires very little in terms of postural exertion. It does require stooping, I believe, up to one-third of the time.
You're sitting with your arm extended, and the phlebotomist is bending over.
I've recently been to a phlebotomist, so you know what it's like, right?
Stretch out your arm, you're sitting, and the phlebotomist bends over and looks for a vein and so on. They better look carefully too, right?
I think if I were to be a phlebotomist, I would probably have to bend over. I'm not sure that someone who's 5'4 would have to.
I think they probably would have to, at least some, but I have a broader problem. The ALJ, a number of times in the opinion, seems to derive or infer from the fact that she receives what the ALJ calls routine and conservative treatment that there's nothing really that much wrong with her. And I think that that is not at all a link that can be made. People in hospice get routine and conservative treatment. And the reason they're in hospice is because they're about to die. So something is seriously wrong with them. People with diseases for which there's no known effective medical cure may get routine and conservative treatment. Maybe they have ALS and they just have, you know, a wheelchair that they can wheel around in, or maybe they have some other condition, perhaps sciatica, for which there is no known medical treatment. So I think to assume that because the treatment you're getting is routine and conservative, therefore there's nothing really wrong with you, is just a logical jump that doesn't hold up at all under investigation.
I think if you closely attend to the reasoning in the decision, Your Honor, you'll find that the ALJ was saying that routine and conservative treatment with a number of her alleged impairments, a number of the impairments that the ALJ found to be severe, controlled their symptoms. So, for example, the ALJ found diabetes.
Work with asthma, right? If she's puffing on albuterol all day long, it's keeping you from passing out, but you're not comfortable.
I think it's difficult to conclude that from the record.
In fact, how do you be a phlebotomist? You need both hands to be a phlebotomist, right?
Yes, according to the vocational expert.
Well, you can't have both hands and be inhaling, right?
Well, I think it's strange credulity to think that she would have to inhale in the middle of. Well, she would take a moment to inhale.
You obviously don't know much about asthma. If you can't breathe, you have to use your inhaler, right? You can't not breathe while you finish the operation.
That's true, Your Honor, but she testified that she was only using it, and granted this is a number of times, but four times a day.
Unpredictable. You know, if you're right in the middle of a procedure, you can't schedule when you're going to need to use the inhaler. It comes up when it comes up. And I guess I'm looking at where the ALJ makes this reference to routine and conservative treatment. And I still have the concern that I mentioned to you. She can't use both hands. She's in pain that's not susceptible to any kind of medical intervention.
I would contend that she can use both hands, or at least that the only reasonable inference from the record that the ALJ could draw, given what the doctor said, was that she could. Because the consultative examiner said that she had, first of all, she didn't report the impairment to the consultative examiner, the trigger thumb impairment. The consultative examiner said that she had 5 of 5 strength in her upper extremities, that she had normal bilateral grip, and I think this is a quote, that she had good, fine, and gross manipulative movements of both hands. She didn't report it to that doctor. It's true that Dr. Kenny didn't cite the impairment from 2009 because the treatment was sort of back in 2009. She had the injection. Apparently that resolved it. And then she testified at the hearing that it was acting up again. But the ALJ held open the record for a month, where there were 2 extensions of 2 weeks, to permit her to augment the record.
But the court is where the ALJ makes the mistake on page 4 of 9 of the ALJ's opinion. Right. She notes non-severe physical impairments of a bunch of things, fibromyalgia, sciatica, left thumb inflammation, arthritis. And then later on she says the claimant also testified at the hearing that she currently does not have any difficulties with her left thumb. And I gather that's not actually an accurate representation of what her testimony was.
That's true. If you look at her testimony, she says, she alleges that she had a flare-up in the few weeks leading up to, or maybe 2 months leading up to the hearing, that she had treatment for it, that it was better, but that it was not well. But then ultimately, the records for that treatment were not added to the record. The ALJ made clear at the hearing that she was relying on counsel to ensure that the record was complete, and in fact this court has acknowledged that an ALJ may assume that a counseled claimant has sort of put her best case forward.
Sure, I mean, but she does testify, and the ALJ doesn't make an adverse credibility determination about that.
That's true, Your Honor, but in the absence of evidence supporting it, I think it would be difficult to conclude that the ALJ would make a different conclusion regarding the manipulative impairment.
Did the ALJ discuss what a phlebotomist does?
I don't think the ALJ specifically addressed it in the decision.
Unusual is that what usually we have in this case, the vocational expert will testify about a bunch of jobs, of which the current favorite is surveillance monitor. Right? You just sit. You don't even need legs. You just sit and look at a screen. Now, phlebotomy, this is more complicated, right? And if that's going to be the job that he finds she can do, doesn't he have to discuss what the job involves? How much standing, how much bending, how much fine motor control you need to hit the vein correctly, and you have to, you know, put a rubber band around above the arm and so on. And then you have to label everything and this and that. It's somewhat complicated. It's more complicated than being a surveillance monitor. So wouldn't you expect the ALJ to try to match his discussion of all her ailments to the specifics of the only job he discusses for her?
Obviously, it would be preferable.
And the other thing I miss, which I think is the most serious, he never discusses these multiple problems she has in combination, right? It's like saying to someone who has no arms and no legs, okay, you don't have a right arm, but you don't need an arm. You know, people can get along without an arm. And then, well, it's true you don't have your right leg either, but people can get along with that. Now, it turns out this person has no limbs at all. But if you go one by one, say you don't need 2 arms, you don't need 2 legs, then it sounds as if you're fit to work. Well, where does he say that person, she's terribly obese, and she has 2 breathing problems, and she has, you know, spinal problems, and she has this, and she has that, and she has everything else. including this mysterious stable angina. Maybe you know what stable angina is. Shouldn't he look at the totality and say, yeah, no one of these is disabling, but someone with such a collection of physical problems is not going to be able to do this rather skilled job. It's not highly skilled, it's not highly technical, but it's not like being a surveillance monitor.
I see that my time's expired.
Do they ever do that? Do they ever look at, does the NALJ ever look holistically at a person's problems?
I mean, respectfully, Your Honor, I would say that the ALJ, if we read this decision and do not nitpick it, that's what the ALJ did, at least to a significant degree. The ALJ addressed the two prime and noted that the two primary complaints that she had, appellant had at the hearing, were her sciatica and her diabetes. Her diabetes was well controlled by medication, and if you look at the consultative examiner's report and ultimately the Dr. Kenny's RFC, which is the only RFC opinion given in the record, they take into account her cardiac condition, her asthma, her ability to ambulate in spite of her obesity and her back impairment. And when you look at the consultative examiner's report, it really, everything that goes to her ability to get around, with the exception of squatting and arising, getting off the exam table, is normal. She was able to walk 50 feet normally, tandem, stand up from a chair normally. The Romberg sign, which is a neurological test that involves putting the feet together, closing one's eyes, and seeing whether they're swaying, was normal, was negative. Everything that had to do with her ability to walk was normal, and the ALJ found that to belie her allegations regarding the severity of her sciatica. It didn't say that it didn't exist, just that she could do more in spite of it, especially in light of what Dr. Kenny said. And because Dr. Kenny is the only doctor of record to speak on the issue of what she could do in spite of her impairments, it's unreasonable to think that the ALJ would decide differently if the court were to remand.
Did he say she could be a phlebotomist?
Dr. Kenny did not. That would not.
So where is the connection between her ailments and this rather specific job?
I mean, Dr. Kenny.
It was step four, wasn't it? It was a step four determination that she could do her past relevant work, although not at this heavy exertional level. I don't understand at all what that means, but that you've got this vocational expert saying her past relevant work was patient care technician, phlebotomist, that she was actually performing at the heavy level, but the ALJ says that she can do her past work.
Well, she alleged that when she was performing the phlebotomy job in the past, she helped lift patients and so forth, especially when she was doing the patient services technician job, which included
That's the heavy part. Okay.
But the ALJ, the VE testified that phlebotomy generally is a light work job, and the agency regulations permit her to return to past work as generally performed as well as she actually performed it. And in this case, the ALJ found that she could return as generally performed.
Do you have any other questions? Okay, thank you very much. Anything further, Mr. Horn?
Just a couple of belated responses to the questions. She's right-handed, although the vocational expert testified that the inability to use the non-dominant hand would preclude the past work as a phlebotomist, whether as she described it or as the Dictionary of Occupational Titles has it. Likewise, she weighs 235. At one point, she weighed 235 pounds during the course of proceedings. And as you say, no discussion of her impairments in combination. And likewise, the district court really didn't discuss the errors in combination. And when you consider the errors in combination, like the impairments in combination, this case has to go back. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Thanks to both counsel. We will take the case under advisement.